Hey, folks, it's Jeremy Kirkland. You're listening to Blammo. Surprise. We got a special episode discussing, quite possibly, one of my favorite watches of all time. This is for all the watch heads, for all the fans of watches, the wrist urology homies, I don't know, whatever you want to call yourselves. I'm glad you're here. If you're new here, first off, I have to tell you, which maybe you find out on your own, I don't even know, but look, I'm a Seiko boy. I'm a Seiko fan, and by the way, you can be a Seiko boy too. You can be a Seiko fan. It's a gender-inclusive term. You can say whatever the heck you want. I like Seiko. I've always been a huge Seiko collector. I mean, to be honest and just frankly speaking, they're great watches. They're super easy to find, to learn about, to collect. They're affordable. I mean, look, I've been collecting and obsessing over Seikos for ages. To be honest, it's how I got into watches. And the Golden Goose, the Holy Grail, whatever stupid expression you want to say, is the Seiko 62 Moss, or what many people know as the classic Seiko Diver. It's simple. It's, in a good way, it's almost like a very forgettable design. But it's so good. You look at it again. You'll hear me talk more about it on the pod, but I love the watch. It's one of my favorite watches ever. And Seiko recently launched a new version of the 62 Moss, which is almost an identical reissue of the classic 6217. That's the 62 Moss that I'm talking about. But this one's called the SJE093. Look, the only thing you and I probably don't like is how difficult it is to remember all these reference numbers. But that's what the internet's for, all right? So, but here's the thing. Naturally, I wrangled in the folks, Rob Kaplan and Zachary Pena from Topper, to help me understand this watch, unpack the origins, and learn more why this little dive watch has every collector going nuts. These are things I do from time to time. It's kind of a phone-a-friend thing. And, and I get to, win because I get to sit and learn about these watches and have the time of my life. So strap in. Jeez, bad pun, right? Awful pun. I should even delete this and start re-recording it. But I'm not. I'm leaving it in there because this is who I am. So let's go ahead and get started. So glad you're here. Let's dive in. People are just like, oh, the market, it's not what it was. Like, I don't know, man. Everyone I know is they're flying watches. Like, people still want to buy cool watches. It's just that's never going away.
I think that what has been affected is the speculation of the commodity watches that are less, that people buy more for value, like certain Rolex and Patek models. Those, I think, have seen an objective slide, but when it comes to people actually buying new watches for that they're connecting with, I don't feel like that slowed down at all.
No. This might be a little bit of a hot take, but I think a lot of the... So, Rob, to what you're saying about the commoditization of those, like, hotter type watches, I feel like a lot of the sales and transacting that we were seeing, even when the market was white hot, was still like dealer-to-dealer transactions. And these were not all dealer-to-collector transactions. Granted, the dealer-to-collector transactions were certainly happening. But I think what's happened now is that the dealer-to-dealer stuff is completely dried up because everybody's holding the bag on whatever inventory they have. And no collector is going to get something for, 1.5x or 2x retail at this point when they can, when the wait lists are being shortened or the values have completely fallen. So, self-correction.
Interesting. My thing is like, I don't know, I still can't get all the watches I want, which is also why we're talking about this pod, because this, I will go on the record here. I thought I was booted off the list because this was... it still is. It's a very difficult watch to get. Speaking about the new, the SJE 093, which is basically, in my opinion, the most perfect Seiko diver of all time, referencing the 62 Moss. No one can even see this, but I'm holding it in my hand like I'm Gollum and it's my precious. And this is also a record here. I've had this watch since I got this from you. I have not taken it off, worn any other watch since. I haven't had to set the date or anything because I haven't taken it off. Like, it's on my wrist nonstop. This watch was so stinking difficult. When you messaged me, I was like, oh my gosh, like I didn't even know. Like, I thought it was gone. Like, I thought I was booted off the list.
Right.
And so this is like this, I don't know what it is. This like phoenix rising from the ashes, because this was announced a while ago, but like most watches, I don't think people got that truly excited about it until it started to get in people's hands. And the amount of DMs I've received over this watch, you know, even people asking me to take pictures of it in different lights, which go talk to a dealer, folks. I'm not the guy. But like, you know, trying to compare it with all these things, like it's, I don't know. I don't think I've been this happy or excited about a watch in a very, 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 very long time. And
you've been a fan of 62 Moss references for a long time. What other similar Seikos have you had?
So I have the Japan Domestic Edition SPB, which is it was like a 40.5 millimeter. I think it's the 153. I don't know, but it's a brown dial. I love that. And then I also have the actual like market edition, which is like the gray dial one of the same. And I was wearing them. But here's the thing.
Yeah.
There's, and this is a tough thing, I think, for people who want to buy watches, which I'm going to admit here, like how it sits on the wrist, which is what many people talk about when they're getting into watches and like how it feels. This feels an order of magnitude different than what an SPB feels like. And I am not saying that that watch is a bad watch. It's still a great watch. But how this feels on my wrist, the build quality, the fact that like these sides are polished, which I don't think ever, you know, I would never say that that makes a difference. It makes a huge difference. I mean, the clickiness of the bezel, I feel like I could make an ASMR video on this. Like, I mean, it's just so perfect. And this is like the king of all the watches. I'm kind of scared what's going to happen with this because how can you do better? Like it's over. The end. This is the end of the show. This is the best pod. Like, I mean, it's just so good.
It is a fantastic watch. It is probably not over.
But no, yeah, but of course not. But yeah.
I thought that in 2017 when the SLA 017 came out, yeah, that it was over.
And I think that's the thing too, is because if you were a fan of the original Seiko dive watch, which people refer to as the 62 Moss, which I will also go on record, I really had no idea what it meant. You know, you guys educated me that the 62 had to do with the caliber, and Moss was automatic self-dater, which who knew? Now I know. Yeah, the first one, they had the SLA, which was a pretty expensive watch. It was bigger, but it had the same big crown. Then you had the one with, I think it was like a Grand Seiko high beat movement in it, correct? And that was a different.
That was part of the 55th anniversary.
Yeah.
That was the, I think the SLA 037, which was celebrating blue.
Yeah. And now, and also those watches were bigger. This is the first new Seiko that's like the 62 Moss that has the original size.
It's pretty funny because Seiko, yeah, for the better part of the last like 10 years, has come close. They've like paid tribute to that reference numerous times in various like tributes and recreations. And like the 55th anniversary, it was blue. And like they get a little bit closer with every,
yeah,
with every iteration, but they remove something that pulls it short of being exactly like the original. And true, that's what makes the SJE so interesting, is that like they pulled out all the stops. I mean, right down to the packaging. How cool is the packaging? I mean, they went full gas, soup to nuts on this thing to make sure that like everything was as close to the original as possible.
Yeah. And in many ways they improved it too. I mean, so the fact that they improved the water depth. So this is a 200 meter water resistance. And also I didn't realize this. Like most watch nerds, I do carry a, what is this? An ultraviolet little flashlight.
You know, torch.
A yeah, blue little, light, if you will.
Yeah. A little UV torch here. Which by the way, for folks who really want to get one of these, you don't have to go find a super expensive one. Go find one that finds a pet urine and bada bing. Anywho, they have the little pip loom at 3 o'clock, which is what keeps it diver certified. But also the loom on this watch is just an order of magnitude better than the loom on any of the Rolexes I have owned and own at this moment, of any Omega. And like, again, I'm not trashing these watches, but like this watch, this build quality, how it feels, you know, the signed crown, all of these things, it's like every little detail is either improved or just refined. I mean, it's, I don't know, but yeah, I haven't taken off my wrist. I'm going to Japan at the end of April and I'm bringing this watch. That's serious. I'm just, there's no other point. Like it's got to go home.
you touched on something a few moments ago that I really liked, in that like every few years a watch comes along like this, where like it's like on paper, it gets a lot of things right.
Yeah.
But like in the metal, it just feels right. It's like, yeah, there's all these intangibles that add up to something really, really special. And I feel like there have been numerous iterations. The Tudor Black Bay I feel like is always a good comparison to what we're talking about here, kind of with the SG. Yeah, the there's so many versions of the Black Bay. There's the 54 and the, you know, there were versions that came really close for some people and then versions that just didn't make any sense for other people. And when you find the one that just clicks with you, it kind of feels like Nirvana. And you're like, I guess I'm done. Like, kind of what you're saying a moment ago. It's like,
yeah,
we're done here. I'm good. This is all I need.
Which I'll also have to admit to myself. I said I was done buying watches like 6 months ago. And
the trick, though, is to say you're done saying done. So I'm done saying done. That's where we'll draw the line.
Yeah.
Onward.
Yeah. Rob, I do have a question for you because you've been in, you know, you're a co-owner of Topper. So it's family run AD. You know, you sell Seiko, Grand Seiko, Omega, Longines. I mean, tons and tons of watches, even super high end and independents like Chopic and Moser and stuff. But so you're in the thick of it at all times. For me, the candy store still feels like a candy store. How do you like measure what really like checks the boxes for you as a person who is around all of these watches all of the time?
I think it starts with theme. Like for me, the most important pieces are the ones that create an emotional experience with something that's happened either to me that's part of a greater story or part of a collection. So to me, if we're bringing it back to this watch, it starts with the SLA-017, which was the predecessor to this watch, which came out in 2017. That was the first time we really added luxury Seiko to our offering. And what's interesting is we had already been a Grand Seiko dealer for about 5 years before that. Mm-hmm. So we actually discovered, at least from a retailer standpoint, we discovered Seiko after Grand Seiko, which is, I think, unusual, as you would imagine most people's journey to be.
Right.
Probably the opposite of what most people would expect. But I just remembered just the amount of people who liked other types of watches and who I knew for liking other brands of watches wanting to get an SLA 017. And I remember just looking at the three-dimensionality of the markers, the dial color, the overall look, how the watch had different design cues than most Seiko divers I knew, which of course have the crown at 4 and are much more focused on sides that are much more angular. And it just looked like such a different type of piece to how I thought of a Seiko diver. I kind of fell in love with it. Now, if I had that feeling from 2017, and here we are, fast forward 7 years later, I fell in love with this watch because of the ways they were able to get this watch closer to the original than the 2017 watch, which I've said for 6 years was my favorite modern reissue piece. I think if you look at the thing as just an item and you take away my experiences that I've had, I still would like it, but I don't know that I would have felt a need to add it to my personal collection in quite the same way, because without the stories and the feelings, the things to me don't have as much power.
Right.
So every time I look at it, I think about, you know, just how all of the just symbolizes like all of the Seiko events we've had in our store, all of the cultural things that we've done that kind of to me all started with that SLA-017.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and that watch, I want to also call out, and Zach, I want to hear from you about this too. Like, so with the SJE, which is the watch that we're talking about that's in my hand, people saw it and they were like, oh man, that's expensive. That's expensive for a diver. But when people compare it to the SLA, it's cheaper. It's cheap. I mean, the SLA came out at, I think, a little over $4,000. You probably know more, but I think it was like $4,100 or something like that. And this is, you know, what like $600 cheaper.
I do have one thing to point out. The SLA 017 did come out with a bracelet too. So that can probably, it was a bracelet and a strap as a combo. So that can be explained as part of it. But watches are certainly more expensive now than they were in 2017 because of currency changes and other reasons. So you're absolutely right. Even if there isn't a bracelet, it's an amazing value for what it is in sort of 2024 money.
That watch had an 8L caliber, right? Which is essentially a slightly less finished Grand Seiko movement, was it not?
Yeah,
that's correct.
Okay.
And that came out at 2000 units when that came out. This right. is 1965 units, so just a little bit less than that. It's, I mean, because look, I'm saying this for the collectors who are like, well, you know, what's the hype factor of it? And like, I get it. I'm not that guy. For me, I'm always more the passion person. But for those collectors who are kind of measuring it, and you know, because people are like, well, how does it sit against a Black Bay 54? Well, they're two different watches. Period. Like, you know,
I think that one of the big misconceptions about this watch mm-hmm. is it was criticized for having a movement that it didn't have. So for instance, there is a 6R caliber
yeah.
in the $1,200 price point variants of the watch. These are the same movements you would see in an Alpinist, etc. And so a lot of people you would see in the comment section would be like, $3,500 for a 6 series movement, what's up with that? Thing is, 6L is very different than 6R.
Yeah.
And 6L37, which is the newest caliber that they came out with for this watch, is a further refinement of 6L35. So 6L37, if you look at Seiko's like maintenance sheet, the accuracy thresholds of a 6L37 are nearly identical to the 8, and like the service cost is like the same.
Yeah.
So it's not like the care that Seiko would take to maintain and keep the movement going is the same as the 8 series. So the difference is the movement is so much thinner that they were able to do a case back that is as flat as possible. You were talking earlier about how the watch fits on your wrist and how good it is.
Yeah.
And the reason is, if you compare that to an SPB 143, which is sort of the main gray $1,200 price point, or even the SLA 017, which has been my favorite watch ever, those watches have much more three-dimensional case backs because they're trying to conceal the thickness of the movement. The SJE movement is so flat that they're able to completely recreate the reissues with a thin mid case and without yeah. a case back that cheats. Because that's the thickness workaround for watchmakers. You have a thin mid case and then you have a three-dimensional case back where you add a millimeter or two to put the rotor in to sort of conceal the thickness. But if you look at that watch in your hand, it's a very flat case back. There's maybe
I just want to say,
a millimeter.
I feel like when we're talking about intangibles, things that make a watch fit better than others, people are obsessed with... So for the longest time, everybody was obsessed with case diameter.
Yeah.
38, 40, 42, 45, yeah. whatever. And then we sort of wised up and we realized that lug to lug was really the measurement that mattered. The measurement from the bottom lug to the very top of the lug. And so generally speaking, anything under 50 millimeters was going to be a little bit more manageable for most wrists. The sweet spot for a lot of folks is kind of 46, 48 millimeters roughly. Now, I feel like the real measurement, and this is sort of like watchmaking's dirty little secret to what Rob was saying, is the case back. Because you can have watches that have very modest lug-to-lug different distances and very modest case dimensions. So again, 40, 42, whatever. But depending on the shape of the case back, it could make the watch sit very awkwardly on the wrist, even if those other measurements are quite agreeable. And the shape of that case back, which is designed to obviously accommodate the movement inside, it plays such a hugely important role in whether the watch kind of hugs and like fits into the little recesses of the bones on the wrist, or gets top heavy and kind of tips back and forth. And even, I would say, even a well-designed case back and a relatively thick or tall watch can still sit pretty comfortably if the case back is sort of ergonomic and kind of the right shape. And what makes this SJE so cool is that, again, to Rob's point, like for so many years, Seiko was kind of hiding the fact that they couldn't get all of the dimensions shot for shot like the original, because the movement was holding everything up. Because of the thickness of the movement, they had to use a thicker case back. So they were using all these little kind of workarounds. Visually, the watches looked like the originals, but on the wrists, they didn't wear like the originals. And if you've ever worn an original 62 Moss, shout out Eric Strickland. You know, he basically is a prolific Seiko collector here in the Bay Area. The man has a veritable museum. I hope he doesn't mind being shouted out on this pod. But having seen and worn his vintage examples, I can say that this new SJE is so faithful to the original in terms of how it wears and not just in how it looks. And so much of that is just because of the case back.
I think Eric certainly won't mind. One of my favorite episodes that we've done of Burlingame and Park was We had him bring one or two of his best historical examples of 62 Moss watches, and we didn't show him what the reissue was like, and we showed it to him for the first time live on the pod. So you got to hear the perspective of certainly North America's foremost historical Seiko collector live react to this watch, and he was incredibly impressed with it.
Yeah. And for folks who are curious, like what that watch is, when we're talking about the 62 Moss, it's a reference 6217, which is like a, if you can find them, they're pretty expensive and they're, you know, pretty difficult to find in very good condition. I have one that's not great condition, but it's nice to wear, like as someone who also collects vintage, it's nice to wear a watch that like you're not really worried about. You know, I have a toddler. And I have a 6-year-old and I'm picking them up. And, you know, so today, full disclosure, I had yogurt on this watch. I had all sorts of stuff on this and it didn't matter because I just washed it off. In fact, I showered with this watch. That's a whole other argument for people who sleep and shower with watches, but like showered with it, it's good. And if, you know, when I wear my Pogue or the 6217, which I barely ever wear because it's, you know, really special and kind of fragile, I can't do that. And I think for folks who are collectors, like getting a new one and getting something that's nice that you can really live in feels really good.
Well, especially because so many of those older watches, the proportions were just amazing. And, you know, movements were, Rob, correct me if I'm wrong, but movements were maybe across the board a little bit thinner, historically speaking. And so a lot of the cases could be thinner, going back to what I was saying about the case backs. And so to be able to get the wear experience, I think we've been so preoccupied with whether a watch visually looks like the original or not. But like the real next level to this, you know, sort of like the galaxy brain version of this is not whether the watch looks like the original, it's whether it wears like the original. And being able to get it to wear like the original is so much more dramatically difficult for watch manufacturers these days.
Yeah, I agree.
And that's what Seiko really nailed with this.
So. Yeah.
So to your point about the fragility of the historical ones, I believe the bezel, Zach, correct me if I'm wrong, wasn't the bezel made of Bakelite on the historical 62 Moss?
I think so. Materials notwithstanding, I do know many of the originals were, I mean, they were tool watches, they were worn, they were beaten to hell. And so like being able to find one, to Jeremy's point, being able to find one like in good working condition that wasn't completely torched from many years of like hard wear is quite difficult.
And a lot of them have the pips that have fallen out at 12 o'clock, round circular dots. And some of the loom sort of erodes off of the markers, and there can be a little, of course, discoloration. Whether it's beautiful discoloration or historical discoloration is truly in the eye of the beholder. How's yours? Do you like the patina on yours? Are you happy with it?
No, I mean I'm the worst collector ever because I don't really like all that stuff. I'm the person where, you know, when I first started collecting, I had bought a Tudor and I went and paid to get it restored. And I remember telling some friends of mine and they were like, "What are you doing?" And I was like, "Well, the dial was all kind of messed
up."
They're
like, "You threw a baseball through a stained glass window to put up a modern window."
Yeah. And I mean, because the thing is like, I want to, yes, I collect like other people, but like, I want to wear them, you know? And it was only a friend of mine who recently kind of like freaked me out on some collecting when he was like, "Well," he's like, "I don't really buy vintage watches anymore." I was like, "Why?" He's like, "Well, I don't know what that person was doing when they were wearing the watch," which is like a very weird thing to think of. But he was just like, "I don't know." He's like, "What if this guy was like, you know, a bad person or that?" And I'm like, "Well, first off, I'm going to be very clear. I don't believe in that sort of stuff where there's like, you know, aura that was transferred." But it made sense to me in the fact that like the story of this watch starts with me. Now that I have it, it's me with my kids. It's me doing all the dumb things that I'm doing, from vacuuming my house to bumping into the walls to taking it, you know, back to its homeland in Japan in April to like, you know, so that is something that makes me very excited about. You know,
I feel like the owner's original aura, the aura being transferable, only works when we're talking about like vintage 1970s Camaros. Like beyond that,
I don't really think
you
it
sell
applies.
It and then it wipes.
Yeah,
you
sorry,
wipe
Eric.
Clean.
But
Yeah.
We actually sell ceremonial sage for that. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, that there's a whole new thing.
Do you bring the watch into a new room in the house and you smudge the room first?
Yeah. But no, my 6217, I have it in a safe deposit box with a few other watches that are more or less, you know, I just don't wear them. And it's a fun watch. Like it is, it's cool. But yeah, I mean, you can, the one thing that I'll say is it really rattles and there's nothing wrong with the movement, but you can just really hear that thing. And this watch is just silent. Like I don't hear, I mean, obviously it's a movement that is, you know, decades of improvement, but, I don't know. It just feels so much better and nicer. And I can kind of rewrite my story with, and like other folks who were asking, the SJE also has lug holes on the side. So for all those NATO boys out there who want to get nuts, have fun with your easy lug swapping. But I'm probably going to use tape.
No matter how easy you make a strap for me to change, I can still scratch it. So
oh yeah, I got the little tape.
I'm terrified of changing the strap.
I feel like my most scratched up lugs are drilled because you just push the pin in and you kind of just yank it out.
Yeah,
and as it yanks out, it scrapes a thing in the side. So I feel like it's a misnomer if there's holes in there. And also Seiko uses most of the Seikos that have drilled lugs have shoulderless spring bars. So there's no way to put a spring bar tool in there anyway. So you push the pin in and you yank it out. And
well, now I'm getting
anyway,
freaked
I'm
out.
I'm just trying to scare off your listeners from changing
their
straps.
Well, you scared me off.
They absolutely should. I do prefer the tool. And I will say that after I bought spring bar pliers, it changed my life. And they were expensive, but like I put off buying them for way too, I mean, I literally bought them last year and I've been doing this for many years.
Same.
And I was just like, why did I wait? I've bought so many dumb straps and so many dumb things and not bought the pliers. I should have bought them on day one.
Did you get
Yeah, it's the Bergeron. Yeah. It's the Bergeron where you kind of adjust it.
It's like a tweezer. It's like an oversized
tweezer. Exactly.
Yeah. It is.
And you have a couple sets of screws. You have a couple sets of screws that you kind of use to adjust the tension and the lug span to make it fit. And then it's the dorkiest, probably most expensive thing I have in sort of my tool drawer here. And I have this over like actual manly like power tools and things that are useful around the house. Like
take that, old Milwaukee.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
But one of the other things that I was going to say, because earlier I was talking about the loom. So I had this watch, you know, like I fell asleep and I was sleeping with the watch, whatever, judge me. But I'm in bed and my wife was like, Jeremy, like turn your phone off. And I was like, what are you talking about? And it was my flipping watch. the loom was just that bright and I hadn't like charged it with a torch or anything like that. It's just so killer. I really can't wait.
So really that brings up an interesting point. Whenever a company does a reissue, they always have a choice to make. And the choice is basically this. Do they want you, the wearer, to imagine that this item has floated through the decades and has aged? Is there faux patina? Are there signs of aging in the markers?
Mm-hmm.
Or is it sort of like you are in 1965 and you walked into a store and picked it up like that day? Do you have like a time machine? And we actually did an Oris limited edition that sort of explored that theme, but that's another story for another time. There isn't faux patina on this watch. And the biggest cost, aside from however you feel aesthetically about it, and there's no right or wrong answer about how you feel about faux patina, the biggest cost of faux patina and those design choices is the loom is never like that. Nobody ever took a watch with a lot of faux patina on the markers, wore it to bed, and had their wife ask them to turn their phone off. That doesn't happen. So that is one of the things that I definitely like about this type of choice is this is not there is no attempt to make this look like it was passed through the decades. This is the original packaging. Open it. This is your time warp watch to this alternate place where you could have got something that looks like this.
Yeah, you can watch like YouTube unboxing videos and stuff of it, but the packaging is pretty gnarly, especially like, I mean, I have other Seikos and even Grand Seikos and stuff, and it's cool because it's presented to you laid out versus a lot of other Grand Seikos or Seikos, which is, you know, it's already rolled up in the box and stuff. And it's, you know, I mean, that white box, I immediately like put it in and set it aside. I mean, it's, yeah, I gotta keep that fresh.
My favorite part is the gold font on the inside cover, just how big the writing is. Yeah. It just, I love that.
Well, going back to what you were saying earlier, Rob, about you know, theme, it's, you know, Seiko makes a lot of watches. Yep. And it's amazing to see one that takes such a strong, concerted point of view from not just the history of the watch and not just the faithfulness sort of to the original, again, going back to what we were saying about not just the dial, but like the case architecture as well. But they took that all the way to the packaging. And I would say that, like, you know, bless their hearts, Seiko's packaging has always left me very whelmed,
fair
if
criticism.
I can say that.
Yeah.
And this packaging actually felt like somebody was like, yeah, let's do this right. And I love that you pointed out that it lays flat, because, like, you know, most watches of that era didn't come on bracelets, they came on straps. And so they were these sort of lay flat type boxes, these long, thin, rectangular shaped boxes. They really went for it. I think, you know, we could certainly put a photo of the box, and to your point, there are unboxing videos on YouTube, but I really think, you know, if you're going to get one of these, spare yourself sort of the, like, don't ruin the surprise. Get the watch and have like a moment when you unbox it, because it is kind of a special thing. I thought that was extremely cool. And it was very cool to see, again, Eric Strickland's reaction. He was also quite surprised that they had like, oh, he was like, oh, wow, they really like cared this time.
Yeah.
They did the box too.
Well, I think that's the thing too, because it does reflect, you know, this is not a $1,500 watch. I mean, we'll confront the elephant in the room, but I do believe that it is worth it down to every detail, including, this is the other thing too. I mean, one of the biggest watch companies in the world does a very, very beautiful anti-reflective coating underneath the crystals that are underneath the crystal, you know, which is how we're viewing the watch. And this is also on there. And I would argue even in some cases further, as the second hand is polished. I mean, put it under my little magic Oculus. I mean, what are these things called that everyone gets upset? One of the loop systems. I even have one of these loop systems, and looking at it, the freaking hands are polished. I mean, which is just crazy level of detail and things that you would find on, like, you know, watches that are 5-6 times that price. So, I mean, it's worth
it. So the buzzword normally associated with Grand Seiko, of course, as far as case finish goes, is Zeratsu polishing.
Yeah.
And Zeratsu polishing is when the side of the wheel is used, and the idea is to get a perfect distortion-free finish. Zeratsu polishing is used on this level of Seiko watch as well. And the biggest test to show Zeratsu finishing is you look at the side of the case, open up a book, and you put it down on the writing, and you look to see in the case, is there distortion of the letters? And if the watch isn't perfectly polished, the letters come out kind of like a funhouse mirror, where they get sort of large. But if you look at the side of, if you look at writing through sort of the mirror aspect of the side of a case, you'll see perfectly formed letters without any distortion.
And Seiko uses these buzzwords to describe Zeratsu. They say it's distortion free mirror.
Do you see it? Are you trying, Jeremy?
I'm using my Dominic Hasek hockey card that I found at my mom's house.
How's it looking? How's Dominic looking?
Pretty damn good.
And they use these buzzwords, distortion-free, mirror polishing, but no one ever really explains what that actually means. And this is the party trick for it.
Yeah.
It works pretty well if you just lay it on like a book, so you get nice high contrast, like on an open flat page. The hockey card, I'm sure, would work just as well.
Yeah, that's what I was doing. Yeah. damn, it's sick.
Can you tell how many goals he had in us?
Well, he was a goalie.
Yeah. His best year.
But this is from the 1996 Sabres, his rookie year.
You can read his power ranking.
You have any stats to read to us off the side of the SJE 093?
Yeah, sure. Well, he was 5'11", so me and Dom were about the same. 165, a little bit better shape than me. Let's just be honest. Yeah, it's crazy. Thank you, Don Russ Trading Card Company, product of the USA.
Shout out friend of the pod, Don Russ. Trading card company.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, I am waiting, like any other watch collector. I ordered a bunch of other straps. I'm going to be the guy who wears a leather strap on the dive watch. I'm probably just going to be that guy for a while. but
it's a good look.
It is a good
look. It's a good look.
Yeah.
Two hot takes here. Leather straps on a dive watch. It's a good look. And also, like, I just, the faux loom thing, faux is not a thing anymore. Like, it's black and tan. Mm-hmm. Tan looks awesome. I think part of the reason that, like, people loved vintage watches was not that, like, they were old. It was that they had that, like, cool, creamy and black look. And it's like, it doesn't need to look vintage. I just want cream and black because it looks dope. And I think Panerai did... Some brands sort of perpetuate this themselves. Oh, it's faux Super Luminova. It's like, you know, Panerai fully leaned into it. Like, nope, it's Ecru colored. It's cream. Off we go.
Yeah, they did do green loom compared to a lot of other folks that do blue loom. That's a little nod, but...
That's a good little nod.
Yeah. The, you know, a lot of people have DM'd me, have asked me, like, oh, because I also own a Black Bay 54, and they're like, this or that. And I don't, you just buy both. I mean, it's just a completely different watch. I mean, I'll still wear my Black Bay on occasion, but I mean, I haven't worn anything since I got this. And
the Black Bay to me feels like a small dive watch, whereas the SJE feels like a very like classical. I feel like they hit it right. They hit it right kind of in the middle. And again, like that was a big dive watch back in 1965. It was quite a large size compared to what else was available, but they had to be more legible. That was just sort of the size that they landed on.
Yeah, I mean, and they sold it as, I mean, this SJE is sold as a dive watch because not only is it diver certified, but I mean, let's just be honest, this strap, nobody's got wrists this big. Oh, they do if they're wearing a dive suit. So yes, that does make sense, versus some of the other watches. It's like, it's more of like, yeah, you could dive in it, but we know you're not. And, you know, Seiko's just like, nope, you know. You may not dive in it, but if you do, it's ready. 200 meters is a lot. That's a lot.
So if we're talking strap length, just sort of to keep it real and to not 100% just gush about this, just to have a little credibility check. The one thing I have heard that can cause a little bit of frustration with this watch is if your wrist is somewhere around 6.5 to 6.75 inches. When you put it on tight, you can see a little bit of the edge of the tail when you're looking just past 12 o'clock.
Yeah, you can, which is what I have.
So the life hack of that is you just slide the keeper up a little bit and then it goes just like you did.
Yeah.
And then it goes away. But also I think a lot of people who are buying different straps for it, you know, will get around that. This is a strap design that is really a fit everyone strap. So it will fit people of, you know, 8.25 inch wrists, and it'll fit 6.25 inch wrists because the holes go all the way up.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the other things too, because I'm like trying to go through all the DMs that I had received about this. You know, earlier we were talking about collectors, and when you look at all the different dive homages that have been created, what is the one that's the most limited is this. And what is the one that's, you know, I mean, if I'm glad that you guys have them, because serious, even like Hodinkee commenters have been like, oh, this watch has been sold out for ages. Like people are like, how did you get one? Who did you bribe to get one?
I think what it is like when a company has a limited edition and the limited edition is 1965 pieces, when they're done at this level, they are not made beginning to end in one big run. It takes a lot of work, a lot of care, and different portions of the run are made at different times. So I think that the reason why you got yours in February when this watch was announced a year ago or at the end of beginning of March, I don't, anyway, the reason why you got it late is because this is when this part of the production came out.
Yeah.
So that is why you got it. Sometimes we'll see watches that came out 4 or 5 years ago, but we'll get a new reference, shipped to us. That was part of a limited edition. That doesn't happen quite as often with a white hot watch like this, but it does take time. And just because when you have a company that's as disciplined as Seiko, just because something is super hot and everybody wants it, they're not going to rush their production schedule. They are going to do it the right way and finish it when they can. And there sometimes will be a lapse.
Yeah. I mean, which I think is good, because there are other companies, which we'll not name any names, where sometimes they'll rush to get everything out. And then occasionally you have a couple QC issues here and there. Like, I would be shocked if there was a bunch of issues on any of these deliveries. I mean, yeah, it's just, it's good. I mean, it's good. I'm very, very grateful I got one. I'm still wondering like how this will be topped. I'm sure they'll find something else. Next thing you know, they'll do some Orange Monster Ultra Lux wild movement that I'll get nuts on. But
well, Seiko, Rob, correct me if I'm wrong. Seiko has had two kind of dive watch firsts. Not first, but there are sort of two early 1960s references that they've paid tribute to a number of times. Eric Strickland has both of these. But you know the architecture. Basically, all of Seiko's modern dive watches are essentially pulling from the architecture and sort of visual design of these two references. One is the 62 Moss, which has the rectangular markers, which is what, of course, what Jeremy has. This is the newest version. And the other has the round markers with more of like the chevron at 12 o'clock, and then the round applied markers that encircle the dial. Rob, do you know that original reference? And that was also an early 60s piece.
6100-6008 is the Wizard. But I honestly don't know. I don't know vintage Seiko numbers.
No, that's okay. That's okay. Yeah, so the 62 Moss was 1965. And then the other reference that I was talking about, again, had like the applied circular markers and the chevron at 12. That actually came in 1968. So not early 60s, like I said.
But by then, the crown was at 4 and it was very angular, right?
Mm-hmm. Correct. That's right. And that case also had like sculpted sides as well.
Right.
More of like the lyre lug shape, similar to what we've seen on like the modern Seamaster as well. So the case itself was quite a bit more sophisticated, but a completely different reference.
Yeah, it was a much beefier case too. I mean,
yep. Well, yeah. That's what makes
And that
the
was
62.
The high beat. That was the high beat reference too. Yeah. So
that's what makes the 62 Moss so interesting, is those crown at 3 o'clock flat side watches really didn't have an incredibly long period of expansion and existing. By the late 60s, Seiko had really found sort of a different design language, a design language that I also love very much. We did a limited edition in 2018 that was like a PVD version, well, IP, they would say. An IP version, it was called the SPB 107. It was nicknamed the Topper Ninja. That was like a blackout version.
I have that.
Of that Mini Marine Master with the very angular sides. So the 62 Moss, sort of exciting to me also, because it's really before they really found their voice and started going their own way in creating the looks that we've all come to love and know, that are so distinctive the second you look at the profile. Because if you take the brand off of 62 Moss and you just look at the case, it will be much harder to tell if it's an Omega Seamaster or if it's a Blancpain Bathyscaphe,
yeah,
or one of the Zodiacs of the time. It would take a much more discerning eye to tell what it was. Whereas if you take the profile of those 68, 69 Seikos, I think almost anybody can tell what they are just by looking at the case lines.
Yeah. And I'll kind of pivot for a moment. I think a lot of criticism that people will lob that like aren't into watches are like, I don't understand why everyone's getting excited about a watch that's new, that's similar to a watch ages ago. Like if you own a watch company, why don't you just make that watch and only make that watch forever? Well, one, let me introduce you to the Rolex State Trust. But two, the thing about this stuff and all these watch companies, it's always about innovation. It's always about moving forward. It's always about improving, especially, you know, Seiko, which, I mean, that's how we got the quartz movement. That's how, you know, I mean, Seiko as a whole is constantly innovating and improving and refining. And so in many cases, it's a bit of a cop out to try to never change or innovate at all. If that really was the case and that was the mindset that everyone had, we would still be walking around with tiny Hamiltons that are hand wound. And obviously if it got too close to anything magnetic, you're screwed. You know, and so I think like that's a thing too that like I always want to try to call out to folks who, you know, are a little bit like casual into watches. And like that's a criticism where people are like, well, like if people love this classic so much, why did they ever change? Why do they ever, you know, do that? And also, like a lot of people, you know, a classic doesn't always come into style. I don't think everyone was crazy about owning a 57, you know, Corvette or something like that until people getting excited about it later. And the ones that own it now, they're still trying to keep it from being set on fire all the time, which is a whole other can of worms.
Have you ever heard the expression, how can I miss you if you won't go away? some of the most classic watches are watches that for whatever reason are out of production. And if you could say the same thing about, you know, certain Hollywood actors or anything. Yeah. It's the popularity of certain things is always heightened when there's anticipation in a long period of absence.
Yeah.
You're kind of a sci-fi guy, right?
Me?
Yeah.
I mean, unfortunately, I've never revealed that to you, but you kind of called it out, which is true. Go ahead. Yeah.
I was just thinking about, you know, if there had not been as long a time period between when Dune came out and when the 80s Dune came out, would it have been as big if there was Dune every year, just as like there's Star Wars every year? I mean, the fact that Dune was gone for so long probably helped build to, you know, the hype of it.
Well, yes, that and also... Now, I mean, now I'm going to get really into it.
And of course, it was a visually stunning masterpiece, too. That doesn't hurt either.
Exactly. Like, you can't make the Dune now then, because the technology didn't exist to make it look that good. I mean, for folks who haven't seen Dune, I'm not going to reveal any spoilers. By the way, the book came out like 60 years ago. 40 years ago? Something like that? It came out like in the 60s, I think. Anyway. But like, how good the mocap is, how good the rendering is, how good all the special effects are, how good all these things, the story remains the same. But it's better because they have better tools. They have better ways to make and manufacture. I mean, yeah, it's similar to watches, right? Like, I'm sure if someone said, hey, look, here's this watch now, then they'd be like, well, yeah, let's just make that one. You know, I don't know if Denis Villeneuve's Dune would be the same as David Lynch's Dune. Yeah. Have you seen the David Lynch Dune?
I've seen the David Lynch Dune.
It's pretty gnarly. You want to see Sting dance around?
Which was the Dune that was like, it was like an 8-tape VHS box set in order to get through it because it was so long. My dad had that, and I just remember it took up, I don't think I never saw it, but it just, all I knew was that it took up half the bookcase because it was like, yeah, it's one movie. It's like all these tapes lined up across the bookcase.
There was a TV miniseries, but I think there was an 84 film.
Yeah, it wasn't that long.
It must have been the 84 film.
I don't think they got it in under 2 hours, but it's yeah. Long. Yeah.
It was long, but he would routinely threaten us that like, okay, you know, if you're not good, I'm going to make you watch this whole movie end to end. Look at the
book. Oh, man, in that case, man, I'd be destroying the house.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Like, sign me up.
Exactly.
Anywho,
I was just going to say that I feel like, just to kind of put a bow on all of this, when we were talking about who is this watch for and why is this different or more interesting than any of the other 62 Moss reissues. And I think, like, you know, not to date this too much, but like the, you know, the white Omega Speedmaster, which was just announced, half of the comments on that watch are, it's a white Speedmaster, I don't get it. And the other half of the comments on that are, for the people who've been paying attention and the people who know that you cannot buy a white Moonwatch for less than $15,000 because they're all limited or precious metal, it's a big deal. And I think the 62 Moss, this SJE, is the same thing. Like, this is a watch that's been very much long awaited for people who've been paying attention. And same thing with the white Speedmaster. If you've been paying attention and you understand sort of the history and the context of the Moonwatch, it's a big deal. And I think that's quite cool. The watch is sort of a secret handshake in a sense. It's not just to the past and present of the brand, for the brand, but also to the people who have been following along and have been waiting for something like this for a long time. So I think it's quite exciting, both the SJE and the white Speedmaster.
Yeah. Yeah, I've definitely, as just a person who loves watches, I mean, looking at just the slightest difference, for me, that makes it a new watch, you know, and that's a new thing to obsess over and get excited about. But yeah, I wholeheartedly agree. When you look at what the value is that you're getting, it's pretty through the roof. So, yeah.
Other thing that could be interesting to talk about is your Seiko Boys hashtag.
Yeah, because people ask me, like, what is Seiko Boys or Seiko Blahs or whatever those things are, where it's like, I was just trying to find a way to categorize and explain how much I loved these watches that at the time, and for me and the people that I knew, I'm adding that in there because I'm going to say this, it was just a very overlooked and underrated brand. You know, I think when many people get into watches, you usually you know, you go from like Swatch or the Crown, right? You get into Rolex or something like that. And there's nothing wrong with that. But I think when you really start to like dig into history and you look for value and you look for the ease of also finding the history versus some companies, you know, they, a lot of that stuff's hidden. I do love the fact that like Seiko basically lets you date their watches down to the month of production, especially a lot of the watches in the 70s, you know, just from their serials. I mean, there's just stuff like that, that for me, it's just a lot of fun to collect. They were easier to find, you know, and I'll say, and, you know, on record, because I sold a bunch of my vintage Seikos to obviously fund other watches and stuff that I was getting. But like, you know, they were way up, you know, I mean, it was way more than what I got. Like just the joy and the excitement of, you know, the Seiko as a whole has just really gone up. And I think that's great. But yeah, like, you know, the whole Seiko boys thing, it's gender inclusive for someone who's going to say that, you know, people aren't, it's gender neutral, it's gender inclusive, it's all inclusive. It's just a way to be excited about a brand and to find cool stuff and to collect. You know, I will say Seiko as a brand is very, very, very protective, as many brands should, as to where their logo goes, right? And I learned this because if you want to put Seiko on clothing, it is extremely difficult to try to go and navigate that. The amount of sign-offs that are required to make a Seiko hat or Seiko merch, it's quite a bit. You can't just throw it out there. And I respect them for that.
I mean, I think when you look at like the breadth of the catalog, like we talk a lot about the originals, like the, again, going back to the 62 Moss, like the original dive watch, but the brand has so much stuff in its catalog and so many innovations just on the Prospect line. We're not even talking about Presage or, you know, any of the other sort of peripheral Astron, any of the other interesting peripheral product lines that they do. And to your point about, you know, accessibility, one of the great thrills of watches and learning watches is sort of like the discovery. You get kind of this high when you learn something new and you sort of dive down a new rabbit hole. And I think Seiko, with its breadth within the company, there are so many rabbit holes to kind of explore in sort of technology and in size and in capability and all of these really interesting things. And we tend to harp on a lot of the same narratives in terms of the Prospects and the dive watches and the origins, for sure, because that's what really gets people excited. But like, for me, the real thrill with Seiko has always been finding stuff that was a little bit left of center.
Mm-hmm.
And to this day, still, you know, even as the brand continues to fine tune many things and stuff invariably gets a little more expensive, there's still Seiko 5. There's still always stuff that remains like an amazing point of entry, an amazing discovery platform, an amazing place to kind of explore and find your feet within the watch space. And that's been really fun. One of my favorite, I'm wearing it right now, one of my favorite Seikos that I've, you know, I've owned many of them over the years. I've always loved the Tuna, but this is the Solar Street Tuna, which is this kind of obscure green dialed Prospects Tuna. It has the solar movement. SNE535 is the reference number. But I love this because we were talking about the long straps earlier. And because this is like a street watch and not like their dive watch, so to speak,
right,
you get the cool accordion style rubber strap, but it actually like fits. It's not the super, super long. It's not designed to fit over a wetsuit because it's a quote unquote street dive watch, even though it has 200 meters of water resistance. So anyway, this for me was sort of the result of much searching and kind of exploring and playing around kind of in the space, because there are dozens of variations of the Tuna. And again, all of this just going back to what you were saying about, it's this exciting brand that kind of has something for everyone if you put the time in to search and to dig a little bit. And I think that's sort of what watch collecting is all about. It's like the digging and the searching.
Oh yeah,
that's where the fun is. And Seiko is like the perfect place to start.
Yeah, agreed. I mean, especially, you know, a few friends of mine, they work in the service, and they have Astrons, which, for folks who don't know what the Seiko Astron is, it's still kind of mind-boggling when you, but it's like, it's a watch that syncs to GPS, but it looks like a regular watch. You know, a lot of us are like, oh, well, that's an Apple Watch now, but like the Astron was doing that for a long time. And they're awesome, just workhorse watches. I mean, and the fact that like they have that, and that same company also makes things like, you know, a White Birch Grand Seiko. I mean, it's cool.
It's staggering.
Well, cool, gents. Thank you, as always. Before we wrap, Is there any other stuff we want to add, mention, plug?
Well, it is the 100th anniversary of the Seiko brand. And by the Seiko brand, I mean the Seiko watch company putting the word Seiko on the dial of a watch. So if this piece isn't for you, we've been told that there will be several more limited editions announced shortly. So there should be some great historical pieces. Whenever there is a watch like this, you can always expect to find similar things when there's a technological breakthrough like this, the thin movement that's in this watch that will be applied to other watches. So I think I'm excited to see how the 6L37 movement's used in other pieces. I think it should be an exciting year for Seiko, even though obviously this piece is a very high mark. It'll be interesting to see what comes next.
Yeah, I'm very excited too. It's going to be a lot of stuff. I mean, I know a few people who got the SPB 441, which is basically a 1,000-piece limited edition, which was Kentaro Hatari's the first actual
little, exactly,
yeah, Seiko.
Right.
So I mean, I'm sure there's going to be a bunch of stuff. But it's crazy. It's an enamel dial watch. For folks that didn't know, I didn't even realize that it was actual enamel. It's pretty sick.
Right. They bake it. So like enamel's always an interesting word because technically enamel can be like the paint that you used on a model racer. I mean, that is enamel paint. And so you could paint it with that and you could have an enamel dial watch but in terms of heated, baked, full processed enamel, as we think of it in the watch industry, I mean, that watch is an amazing value.
Yeah. Yeah. It's pretty sick. So I'm excited to see what else they got in store. It'll be good. Well, gents, thank you again for this. It was great chatting and looking forward to chatting with you soon. I'll see you.
Bye.